Lucky Dube of South Africa, considered Africa's king of reggae, with Till You Lose It All. And the opening was by the Soweto String Quartet, providing a chamber music intro there. That's from Lucky Dube's 1999 album, The Way It Is. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. It is Tuesday, October the 21st. And a couple of things I want to say before we get into the program proper. First is, I want to thank you so much. There was a wonderful response yesterday from listeners of Lead Stories, and it was an energizing finish to the day. It was wonderful, and I want to thank you for stepping up the way you have. I still do want to continue encouraging you to do so. Just to say that we recognize that we have an obligation to support those avenues of information that indeed support us, and the need for the knowledge that is shared on this medium that you won't get anyplace else. So I want to thank you very, very much for your generous support. Thank you. But please do not stop. Those of you who haven't, please continue. The number while we do the program, you have two numbers that you can call, 877-627-5065 and 646-926-5422. We're just asking that as we go along, that you keep this in mind, that this station is worthy of your support. Secondly, I want to remind you that I'm going to be out in Newark, New Jersey this Thursday. At 6 p.m., I'll be at REFAL headquarters, and that is at 269-271 South 9th Street in Newark. I'll be talking about reclamation and rebuilding and rebounding in terms of rebuilding our communities, not just the physical structures, but talking more importantly about rebuilding and reconstituting our families, which, of course, that's been a huge problem. But there are ways to mend things because we have to. It is absolutely linked to our future as a community and as a people. So REFAL headquarters at 269-271 South 9th Street in Newark, New Jersey. I'll be starting at 6 p.m., so please be on time. Okay. Well, it's been a year since I was last in New York City, and of course, this trip around, I try as much as possible to get around to, you know, little places you got to go and do things and whatnot. And in the process of doing that, you just can't help but notice the dramatic change in just 1 year. What has happened in the city? And some people will call it progress. And the question I'm raising today is it? And not just New York City. New York City is kind of an example of what is going on across the nation, especially in major cities, major, as they call them, urban centers, where a lot of activity is focused and not necessarily with all of the people in mind. I'll give you an example of what clearly evidenced itself to me yesterday and in the previous days. With respect to Manhattan, it seems as if somebody decided that Manhattan ought to be a place for a particular group of people. It's organized for their convenience, for their pleasure, for their relaxation, you know, for their quality of life. And the other group of people are those people who are in service to the previous group I just described, taking care of the children, walking the dogs, delivering their meals from the shishi restaurants, taking care of their dry cleaning, and so forth. So there are two groups of people in Manhattan. You're either one or the other. A simple thing. I looked at the parking arrangements now, and it typically will cost you about $7. This is the average person would cost the average person about $7 for the grand privilege of parking on the street. And you say to yourself, now, what exactly is the rationale for $7 to park a car for an hour? In the garage, it would be $20 an hour. What is the point of that? Except to say, indirectly, if you can't afford to park your car, you can't afford a car. But, you know, you as an ordinary person, you go, well, what's next? I mean, what is life supposed to be if you can't? I mean, simple things like that become onerous and they become a real burden. And it's just a simple thing of parking a car. It should not cost $7 an hour to park a car in a street. It is a statement by whoever is making these policies. This city is not for everyone. You don't have, as a resident of Manhattan, you cannot, or even of the city, you do not have any right to assume that the city actually belongs to you as well. The city belongs to a group of people who can afford to pay $20 an hour to park their cars, or a couple of hundreds of dollars. When I left New York back in 2000, in my neighborhood in Brooklyn, I kid you not, this is how outrageous it had begun to be. They were building in my neighborhood, which was a very nice neighborhood, all kinds of people. We had Arabs, we had Latinos, it started out historically to be a predominantly Latino community, Latino and African American, mostly dock workers. And then it became more and more integrated, and then it became a historic neighborhood, and we saw people coming in, you know, the educated groups and professionals and their 2.2 kids and so forth. And next thing was something I just couldn't make sense of at the time. It was called a car condo. They're building a condo for cars. Not even a garage. It was better than a garage. It was to be more than a garage. It was a condominium for cars. And in 2000, the price for a parking spot in this condo was $175,000. Now, you say this to anybody outside of the United States, and they would double over just laughing. What exactly makes a parking spot in essentially a garage worth $175,000 to park your $30,000 car, or your $15,000 car, or in my case, your junket, your $8,000 hoopty? Really? So the signal back then was there are all kinds of ways to empty communities of undesirable people and to introduce into these communities the desirable people. I used to go to Washington, D.C. quite regularly. My brother went to school at Howard, and I also had a friend at Howard. And the neighborhood near Howard was, you know, your basic hood. But soon enough, there was this changeover. And now, like in Harlem, the Washington, D.C. has gone through such a transformation that the people who used to live there can't live there anymore. It's not that they don't want to live there anymore. They simply cannot live there anymore. They can't sustain the cost of progress. Because this changeover of population, which is called progress, comes with a whole bunch of stuff that, whether you like it or not, is going to impact you. The cost of services will go up. The cost of your home will go up. The cost of your insurance will go up. All kinds of things start changing and costing you exorbitant amounts of money. And so after a while, it no longer is feasible for you to hold on. So you are chased out of your neighborhood. You chased out of your home by default. You cannot simply sustain the rapidly rising costs of just existing in a geographic space. Years and years and years ago, all the way back to the 70s, a neighborhood in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, that got absolutely no attention because Latinos lived there and some blacks lived there, and there was public housing there, and the neighborhood was just left to deteriorate, benefiting not at all from services that it was taxed for. Consequently, the neighborhood took the predictable turn. It went further and further down to the point of no return. And at that point, in its shambles, people saw gold. And then came the inevitable turning around point where young people come in, mostly white, and then the apartments that used to rent for reasonable amounts of money are now renting for 3 and 4 and 5 times that. And the same thing happens. Property values go up to the point where people who've been living there for a long time simply cannot hold on. They're now on fixed incomes, or they are at or below the poverty rate, they cannot sustain life where they were for all these years, in some cases for generations. And that's what New York City, Manhattan particularly, Brooklyn, parts of Queens, parts of the Bronx, this is what is happening. So when we see this kind of transformation going, we definitely want to ask a question, well, what happened to community control? How did a community allow itself to be assailed like this and to be literally destroyed in order to, quote, be reimagined? You see the same thing happening in Detroit. We talked about it here. The systematic emptying of the cities. And you see the dire consequences, but they don't matter because the people affected in the first place never really were part of a meaningful group. These were marginal people. These were people who were incidental to the process. So they, you know, whatever happens to them, it's no big deal. The desirable people are coming in, and therefore the neighborhood is worth saving now and worth investing in now. And I was talking to Gary. Gary's joining me now in studio. I was walking around, of course, doing a lot of running around in the city, and the clear shift that has occurred, and not for the better, although people would argue, well, see, if we have more buildings going up and we have more office space and we have parks and we have pocket parks and whatever else we have. But you look at the architecture of the city in terms of its human content, and you can see the devastating blows that have been dealt so many communities. What do you
think? It's true all over the world. When I go to, let's say, if you go to Prague, if you go to London, if you go to Paris, you will see the antiquity architecture and the people who've lived there. This was also true in China, in Beijing. And then in comes the development. The first thing they do is they buy the poor people's land. Mm-hmm. And generally people are so desperate they'll take whatever they're given below market value. Then they clear all that land. Then they put in these gigantic skyscrapers that are not in any way matching the existing architecture. There's no harmonizing of them. And then only the wealthiest people come in there because it artificially forces up the price of a bubble economy, a bubble real estate value. Mm-hmm. And then where do the poor go? Well, now the poor can no longer be in that area because the shops they cannot afford, the theaters they cannot afford. And by the way, I even found this in Camden, New Jersey, when I was filming there recently for the documentary Poverty, Inc. On one side of the street, there was rehabilitation of a row of homes. On the other side of the street was a theater, and the theater only charged $15 for a play. Mm-hmm. And yet when I spoke with people, they said, we've never been there because we don't have that extra $15. So there was no consideration of how you integrate the development of an area where historically they were able to coexist. Not today. The architecture doesn't blend, so you're in London now. Or in Paris, you're walking down a beautiful street, maybe 800 years old. The architecture is 800 years old. And suddenly you get this giant skyscraper right in the middle of the block. I saw this in Vienna also recently. Huge, ugly, sterile buildings beside something that is Gothic. And so that's the idea. And they're doing this everywhere. I look out my apartment here in New York City, and I have an unobstructed view of Manhattan. Now you have two giant phallics just rising in the air.
Two giant what?
Yeah.
What are
phallics,
they?
Phallics. All right? They're the two tallest new skyscrapers that only a person who's a multimillionaire billionaire could live in. Now, all around that, that'll force up the price of all the other real estate.
Exactly.
And it's no different than a small business person. All it takes is someone willing to pay above market rent, then every other place in that area is going to be charging above market rent. And then one day, as my brother Steve showed, 350,000 small businesses have been forced out of business. And had I had any loans, had I had any debt on my health food store, I would have had to close it down because when Whole Foods opened up, on Columbus in 96, all the small health food stores went out of business. And that's true everywhere in America where they open up, because nobody can compete against them, because they can intentionally charge 20% less than anyone else for 3 months. So everyone goes there to buy whatever they're going to buy, and the small health food store that's been there for 20 or 30 years goes out of business.
But from the Lower East Side, where NYU commands a huge chunk of real estate, all the way up to the George Washington Bridge, where Columbia University commands its share of real estate, and on West Side and in Central Harlem and so forth, you find that, you know, people are just being squeezed out. So what does this say about the will of the people and how policy is supposed to be reflective of the needs of people?
All right. First, you've asked two questions that are convoluting to each other. There is no we the people. Mm-hmm. There hasn't been in a long time. When I walked up Riverside Drive the other day just to see what had happened to the environment since the 1970s, it's completely different. If you walk up Riverside Drive from 96th Street to 116th Street, most of those buildings are owned by Columbia University.
That's right.
It's like a French boulevard. They have a beautiful park, Riverside Park, and the buildings are old pre-war buildings. Mm-hmm. They're now going for as much as $1 million for 1,000 square feet. That's big. So you got 2,000 square feet, $2 million, and that's cheap. So when the average building, an average apartment, let's say on 103rd Street, because I'm talking about Peter Roth's building, Peter mm-hmm. Roth, who does a show here, right. And I've known Peter, he's been a friend for decades. Peter has a rent-controlled apartment. It's a big apartment. It's 3,000 square feet. The average 3,000 square foot apartment in this building is going for $4.5 million. This is a neighborhood that used to be an undesirable neighborhood. Then it was an okay neighborhood. And now it's the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So where do the people go who can't afford to be there? You have to go to New Jersey. You have to go someplace else. So what you have is you have this phenomenon of the green zone mindset, meaning that today in America, you have about 6 million net millionaires, net meaning $6 million people who have at least $1 million, excluding their real estate. This is net. Then you have another 4 million millionaires if you include their real estate, all right? Then they're a millionaire. That's 10 million people. That's more people than live in Los Angeles. That's more people than live in New York City. So if every single apartment in all the boroughs of New York and Manhattan were taken, you would still need more rooms for all the millionaires. So millionaires want to be together. So they form green zones where they'll bring in their wealth. And they have expectations, so everything caters to that wealth.
Mm-hmm.
The type of shops that come in there are going to be high-end shops, more often right. than not national brands. And what happens is the people who had lived there can no longer afford to be there and are forced out. And you gentrify it. And that's what we're seeing in Manhattan. So Manhattan now, all of Manhattan and much of Brooklyn, not Staten Island, Lower Harlem from 125th down, pocketed, you have the gentrification. And within another 5 years, it'll be complete, which means that if you have money, you don't want to be where you lived. You don't want to be where you grew up. You don't want to be in Akron. You don't want to be in, you know, the south side of Philadelphia. So we have right now about 500 green zones around the United States. In these green zones, you have a concentration of wealth. You never find a wealthy person wanting to go to a poor area, ever. They want to go to the wealthy people, which means that the wealthy who are there then have a hierarchical order.
Right.
However rich you were, you now become richer simply because you were there.
Right.
So the insiders, now they have 100%, 200%, 300% increase in value of their property. So that's how it's working right now. And that's only going to get worse, not better. You'll have more people who have wealth coming into green zones of wealth, and the people you referred to, mm-hmm. they simply will blend in to wherever they can afford and wherever they can fit. You now have a phenomena of hundreds of commute bedroom communities, mm-hmm. meaning you work in San Francisco, but you got to live 2 hours north. You got a 4-hour commute each day.
That's right.
Because you can't afford anything else. And I was just in Napa Valley 3 weeks ago. I drove through San Francisco. I thought it was as ugly as it could get. It looked like Queens with a mountain behind it, over congested.
Okay, people will be calling from Queens. I understand
that's right. Too many houses too close together. And my driver of the car that took me to the medical conference where I was keynote speaker, he said that he could no longer afford to live where he had for 20 years. And therefore, he had to keep moving further back and further back. Now he has to commute 2 hours each way each day. And that's true in Albuquerque. The people who used to live in Santa Fe no longer live there. They have to live in Albuquerque, which is an hour drive. Mm-hmm. So this is happening in every major city in the United States.
And now that you have to commute, the price of gas, all the things that would support or are necessary for a person to successfully commute, I mean, a working person, that too has gone up. The price of the price of train tickets, the price of bus tickets, the price of everything. It's outrageous what is going on. And I'm saying this is a national phenomenon. So when do people get to the point of saying, look,
because no matter how bad it gets, you have 16 million recently unemployed people no longer looking for work. They are joining a total now. We have 96 million people who can work who don't. Now, some have retired and don't have to, but the vast majority need to and can't. If we took real unemployment of people who wanted to work, needed to work and can't, or underemployed, you're dealing with 24% unemployment rate. We're right where Spain would be. And yet we talk about exceptionalism. The gross domestic product in the United States, which is about $15 to $16 trillion, at least 15% of that is debt. So only in America do we have the alchemy to make debt an asset and say, look how good we are. No, those are people living on their credit card. They just paid their mortgage on credit card. They're buying their car on credit card. They're buying their clothes on credit card. They're eating out and they're paying for a movie on credit card. How in the world can you possibly say when that person's encouraging a 28% interest rate on that credit card debt, how are you saying that that's an asset? An asset's when you use your savings, unencumbered by debt, to buy a car, to go to a movie, to go to take your clothes to the dry cleaners, to buy a new lawnmower. That's what we used to do. Now we don't. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have a negative savings of about 1.2%, and the average American cannot survive for more than 10 days without cash, or they would be in harm's way. We have 150 million Americans at, above, or below the poverty level slightly. So that's one half the American population are living in a no man's land. We have 7.5 million Americans living on less than $2 a day. Historically, $2 a day was considered what you were in dire poverty in Africa or in India. Now we have 7 million Americans living in $2 a day. When was the last time you heard that discussed?
And that's another piece I wanted to talk about, because that is a dramatic change from the last time I was here. Between the subway stop and home, I encountered about 5 homeless people. And what was dramatic about it was that 3 of the 5 were young people. 3 of the 5 were young. When I say young, I would say in their early 20s. Nothing older than 30, but about in their early to mid-20s, on the street begging. And white. This is not to say that homeless people aren't white, but it was, you know, considering that the vast majority of people that I remembered in the city being in the homeless population, I don't remember them being young and white. So that was jarring to me. And it said something about the city, such a contrast. You know, here you have this so-called fast-paced city, the biggest, you know, the hype with the city and all the wonderful things associated with New York. It's, you know, it's a hell of a town. The Bronx is up and the Battery down. The people ride in a hole in the ground. and all of this wonderful things celebrating the city of New York, and you see before your eyes the disintegration, and it is still being made to look like progress. And that is extraordinary. It is extraordinary because it seems to be a one-sided deal, and it seems to be going on without a fight. I mean, a really good fight, a credible fight, a serious fight by the communities most affected. It seems as if, you know, whenever the decision was made that, okay, this is the neighborhood we're going to take, people just say, all right, you know, just do whatever you want. And they come in and do exactly that. I can remember a very different New York City, a city where you did feel you're part of the city. But you feel more and more, certainly I felt it, I felt like a complete stranger in the city. The city that I remember no longer exists. You know, there are people who still live, a few and far between, still live where they used to live. But for the most part, most of the people I know no longer live where they used to live. They can't afford it. And the city is going at 80 miles an hour, is just going along with a pace in progress. But really, I saw it, and it was so stark. You have just two kinds of people in the city, and that's exactly what is going to become in another couple of years. You either are wealthy or you are serving the wealthy. And that's going to be the New York that we will know in future generations. I'll take a little break right here, come back to your thoughts about the subject of what's the relationship between progress and community viability in the city of New York, not just in the city of New York, but where you live, because it's happening all over. And where you live, I am positive there is a parallel story of the same thing going on. But how is it manifesting itself, and what is it causing you to think about this notion of the viability of a community? What is, therefore, a community? What constitutes a community? If we are seeing the fracturing of communities at the pace that we are seeing now, is there any hope at all for this thing, this notion, this idea of community? Right after this short break, we'll come back to your thoughts at 888-874-4888. On PRN.FM, your calls and comments at 888-874-4888. We're talking about communities and whether you are witnessing in your area the disintegration of your community. And what are your concerns about it? Are you aware that your community is undergoing a shift, or has it already undergone a shift? And where are you in the scheme of things? Are you one of the previous people who used to be there, or are you one of the new people coming in? And how does one maintain this sense of community in an atmosphere where there's such an emphasis on money being power, power being money, and it can get anything done? But what is lost is the connection that people used to have that made a community, a very vibrant, living organism. Now, this is not to say that all communities are, you know, wonderful and fantastic and can't use any improvement, but the question is, what we're calling progress, is it really progress? Is it really creating a sense of community, or is it destroying community? And what is the role, therefore, of the people? How do we make our concerns heard and felt over this question of the direction that progress, quote unquote, is taking, where it seems to be destroying the very fabric, the very structure of what is essential to a community? These are very important questions, I think. So, I mean, I raised this because it was just so jarring and so clearly evident to me, and maybe more pronounced because I haven't been in New York for a year, but in that year, so much has gone on that it just, I mean, just screamed at me yesterday. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. Hello, Gary from New Jersey. You're on the air.
Hello, Utrice. Are you there? No.
Okay, you're on the air. I'm hearing you. Hello, Gary? I'm hearing you. Oh, he's not there. 888-874-4888. What is happening in your community? How much of this relates to where you are? What is your experience about it? What are your thoughts about progress and whether it has either enhanced or destroyed the viability of your own community? From Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, Utrice, how you doing?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing good. Actually, what you are mentioning, New York, obviously you probably know it mirrors Chicago. You know, it's funny, Mayor Daley, one of his big FUs to the city before he left, he sold off the rights to the parking for the city of Chicago to a private investment firm. So when Rahm came in, you know, he denounced the deal. However, when he came in, you started seeing parking meters in places that you never thought you'd see parking meters, because generally in Chicago, most of the parking meters were either in downtown Chicago or in particular, you know, upstanding neighborhoods. But then, like, on the south side of Chicago, you just started seeing parking meters, like, all over the place. So, you know, we're like, you know, what the hell is going on here? But, you know, this gentrification and this progress, another thing that I wanted to bring out, Chicago years ago had a big box ordinance. And what happened was the aldermen basically rescinded this, Mayor Daley and the aldermen rescinded this big box ordinance, because that's why it took Walmart and Target to get a store in the city, you know, in 2007 was like their first store. But the thing was that they try to come in and say, we provide more jobs to the neighborhood. Well, you know, the thing I was thinking of was that was what they was calling progress. However, you know, 7-8 years later, Chicago still has a high unemployment rate mm-hmm. in those same particular neighborhoods. So mm-hmm. I don't call that progress. And that is definitely not progress at all. And just like 2 years ago when the city shut down 50 schools, that is also a sign of things to come in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big sign of things to come
Huge.
In Chicago.
Big time.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And it just doesn't have to deal with education either.
No. But thank you for that picture, mirroring the same picture here in the city of New York and all across the country. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
From another big city, Dallas, Sarah, you're on the air.
Greetings to you, Utrecht.
Thank you, and to you, too.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad that you are back in warmer climates. And
no, I'm not yet. Not
oh,
yet.
You're not back?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say,
I'm still here.
Okay.
I'm still here.
Well, thanks for the good reporting, Utrecht, and I will send in my donations at the end of the month. I did not...
I'm thankful for that. I'm really appreciative
of
that.
I will get it in at the end of this month. So I do appreciate what PRN is doing there, and we cannot let them go by the wayside.
No, no. So what are your thoughts about this?
On the regentrification, Utrecht is something that I've been seeing out here in the Dallas area where we are living. Because we live in a pretty mixed area. I would say it's about a third each, third black, white, as well as Latinos. And we are very close to where there's, because, you know, in the metro area here, there's a lot of colleges. There's the very large Veterans Administration Hospital. It's not too far from where we're located. Then we have Southern Methodist University, and we have a lot of colleges that's close in the proximity, and George Bush opened his presidential library right up the street. So mm-hmm. I can see where this area, they have started to regentrify, because once I see them coming in and they started widening the streets, they're starting to repave it, they're starting to repair the sidewalks, and then I'm seeing there's a golf course that's not too far from where we are, but it's been pretty abandoned shape, and they're coming in and they have the big signs up on there redoing the golf course and everything. I said, I know for a fact they're not redoing this golf course just for us in this community. They're getting ready to make the shuffle on, and as I was telling a friend of mine yesterday, I could see within the next 5 years this area here is going to be taken over. It's going to be a predominantly white area. All of the blacks and the Latinos and the people, you know, lower class whites who they don't want to be in the area, you're going to be pushed again, and you're going to have to make another shuffle to find another location to move to. Because that
is there any organization at the community level against it?
I have not seen it.
Making an effort to get people aware that there's a shift happening and it's possibly not going to be a pleasant experience.
I have not seen any Utrecht. There's an African Center right up here. I said they're having a program coming up this weekend. And I was going to go to that program, and I was going to find it from them if they have anything to address what's going on here in the area. Because it's a very nice central location, Utrecht. We mm-hmm. intersect with four major interstates. We have the interstate I-20, I-45 going to Houston. We have I-35 going through to Oklahoma. And then of course, you know, you have I-30 going to Arkansas. So it's in a tight little area here. You have the Cotton Bowl. You have all of these things right here. Reliance Center is right down the street from not too far from where I'm at. You have the right where they have the grassy knoll where Kennedy was assassinated. All of these things are right here within you could get it within 5 to 15 minutes from where we are located. So I know that with the commuting being the factor that it is, and especially with the sports and everything else that is out here, people are not going to want to commute that far in from wherever they're living in. They're going to, if it's right here, they're going to want to be here. And if you're living in this community and it has everything here that they want, and it's a 5-minute shot for them to get to where they have to go to, well, we don't want you people living here, because y'all are not really using what we can make of the area. And then the price, of course, is going to jack up, because I went to the VA last week. I could already see over there where they're putting in, like, little specialty shops and all of these different things, and I know it's not for the community over in that area, because those people over there, they're not going to be buying what they have in these specialty shops the coffee shops and all of these different things over there. So I can see the move is being made, but it's like a lot of us, we are oblivious. And as you said, when the push, when the great big push is on and they have finally moved you out, because they start with a crime statistic. Whenever they start running your zip code and you can't get insurance for your for a particular zip code, it's at a higher premium, then I already know that the move is on, because we went through it in Atlanta, that they are getting ready to put you out of this area, make it a crime-ridden area so that they can come in and buy it up at low cost, push you out, and then all of a sudden you can't come back in.
It's a very scary thing, but, you know, at some point, I'm waiting, I'm being very hopeful here, that somebody would make a stand and say, no, this is not going to happen. This is not a good way
to live.
And it's not right in the end. It's just not right.
No, it's not you, Trish. You know what, you, Trish, but you might be hearing about me on the news, because if I go to this meeting and they don't have anything, I'm going to do as you say, you, Trish, take up an effort, because I've been noticing. I noticed it for the past year, and I'm saying, I'm the only person that noticed it. I went and I talked to some of my neighbors, and they act so oblivious to what's going on as if they're not even aware. And I'm telling them, I said, can't you see this? And these people that just spent all this money to redo this road, and they put in some extra lanes and everything else with the sidewalks. I said, they're not doing it because of us. They're doing it because this is a potential here that they're going to be coming in and reclaiming this area.
Absolutely. There's a lot of it going on. And oddly enough, the communities that are targeted are communities that are politically vulnerable, because their representation of their constituencies, their representation is rather weak. And so the wealthy get everything they want. They get all the concessions from the city. They get all the, you know, the waivers that would normally apply. They get all the inducements and everything they wish to get whatever it is they want. Thanks so much, Sarah, for
your
call today.
You're welcome.
Thank you. From Florida, Lloyd, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Utrecht.
Good afternoon.
I'm a new resident of Florida just since last December, but I lived in New York City, Brownsville, to be specific, from the 60s into the 70s, 80s, 90s, and I've seen vast changes with the gentrification of Bedford-Stuyvesant and East New York. I remember the days when there was just a lot of flat lots, you know, blocks and blocks of buildings destroyed. And then as time went by into the 80s, I started seeing new people coming into certain neighborhoods, especially in downtown Brooklyn, Bedford Avenue, DeKalb Avenue, where they started rebuilding these beautiful brownstones, and noticing that our people weren't the new residents. It was a lot of white people. And noticing how the prices for rent and, you know, and housing just skyrocketed. I've seen a lot of changes in Brownsville. I live close to Brookdale Hospital area, where after a while all of my friends started moving away because they couldn't afford it. And I remember this book that Senator Daniel Moynihan wrote many years ago called Benign Neglect. And it was about how it's like the big developers deliberately blighted certain neighborhoods in the Bronx, in Willits Point over there by Shea Stadium, to deliberately, you know, make the people want to leave the city because they couldn't afford it anymore, or the city wasn't doing their responsibility as for making sure sewage was taken care of and the streets were smooth and people were able to live there, you know. And after reading the book, it's like, wow, this was a plan by the city developers years ago. And to see it to come to fruition, to see, wow, you know, the demographics of traditionally black and Latino neighborhoods changed so vastly in the space of like 30, 40 years. It was scary.
So, Lloyd, With this benefit of hindsight, what should people be doing about the viability of their communities?
Well, that's a hard question. I'm not sure what the right answer would be towards that. I mean, there was a time when I never thought that I'd ever leave New York. And as times went by with Giuliani and then his regime of the way he was running things, Koch before him, it's like slowly but surely the place started looking like a concentration camp for people of color. You know, I used to drive for the city of New York in the transit system, and I went through many neighborhoods seeing, you know, it go one way, you know, like in Williamsburg down the, when you go down Bedford Avenue, mm-hmm. and in the early 80s, it was nothing but flat, I mean, for blocks and blocks, it's nothing but flat land. I think it was the Sephardic Jews that lived down that area, and
the Sephardim,
seeing that they were building up.
Mm-hmm.
And as recently as say 2 years ago, and after I retired in 2010, I go down there now, and it's like every place that was flat has high rises now, and only the Hasidic Jews live down there. And it was really strange to see how quickly they were able to take over. And there's a lot of black people that have the power to be able to.
But the thing is, in these, that development, almost a huge chunk of it is actually federally subsidized housing.
Okay.
That is not private housing. That's subsidized mm-hmm. housing. But we haven't seen much of new housing in communities that definitely need it. But that was a very sore point for the people who had lived there all those years and never, ever got the housing that was needed. Thank you so much, Lloyd, for calling. Where are you in Florida, by the way? Oh, he's gone. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it causes you to rethink this notion, but more than just thinking about it, think about ways in which, you know, you can begin the process like Sarah is in Dallas, doing some kind of networking and getting people to understand that this something is afoot here, and inevitably it will affect you in a very direct way. We seem to be unable to go up against the big guys, the developers who come in, and the people with money who just don't care. All they care about is that they can have their way. And they don't care about the community as such because they don't wish to relate to anybody in the community. It's a place for them to live and to leave from and go do their thing and come back home. But other people have notions of community being about personal contact and interaction and about, you know, the fiber of the community being all throughout the community, belonging to everyone, a sense of cohesion, a sense of identity as a group of people sharing a space. So I hope this brings to your attention this phenomenon of what's going on in New York City here. It's clearly very, very much accelerated. It is going to be that in many urban centers. So just to remind you, again, Thursday, I'm at REFAL headquarters at 973-489-0660 if you wish more information. But at 6 o'clock, I'll be talking there on Thursday. And I thank you so much for your continued support of PRN and also of Lead Stories. I urge you to continue. We have two numbers that you can continue to call. And always say that you're calling for Lead Stories, 877-627-5065 or 646-926-5422. And make whatever contribution that you can. And I thank you very much. I thank you also for the pleasure and privilege of your company. See you tomorrow.